Exploring the importance of having the right skills to succeed. This is Skillfully Speaking, supported by Babcock International. Presented by Skills Ambassador Jackie Grubb.
Welcome to Skillfully Speaking. I'm Jackie Grubb, your host for an episode I am really looking forward to, because we are incredibly fortunate to be joined by Tom Malone Jr. We all know Tom from Gogglebox, where he became a firm favourite, but there are many strings to his bow. World-class professional dancer, breakdancing specialist, and sellout performer around the world. He's also a proud autism advocate, sharing how his diagnosis changed his life and championing access to the arts for all through his infectious energy. Welcome, Tom.
Hey, all right?
Yeah, how are you doing?
That was a nice introduction, wasn't it?
Wow. Well, do you know, I am so excited and I don't really know where to start, because we've just had a brief conversation before we went live on this podcast, and you've got so much to say, so much to contribute, and you've done so much in your life in such a short space of time. So how have you become the person that you are today?
My mum and dad. Is all I'd say, really. Yeah, they made sure that I had all the opportunities that they didn't have.
Yeah.
I've grown up in a big family, so I've got five siblings.
Where are you then in that five?
So I've got five siblings.
Yeah.
So I'm one of six, but I'm number five.
Have you always lived in Manchester?
Yeah. I lived in London for a little bit, but I grew up in Manchester.
Can you remember the first time in your life when you thought that you wanted to become famous, or did you think you wanted to become famous, or did it just happen?
I don't remember in terms of like, I want to become famous. I can't remember a point in my life that I wasn't dancing.
Yeah.
Like, music was always a massive thing for me. One of my earliest memories is being sat on my granddad's knee and him playing me music. And my sister started doing dance classes at like when I was around six.
Yeah.
And my mum, like I said, big family. So she took me along just to sit at the back with her while my sister did the class, and I just started joining in.
Oh, brilliant.
So I think because I always had something I was passionate about, it was more that I wanted to achieve in that field rather than wanting to be famous.
Okay.
At the time, dancers weren't really famous in that way.
Okay.
It was more that like they'd be on big stages, but it would always be dancing behind someone else. Because okay. The era of the Gene Kellys and so forth, that was however long ago.
Yeah. People are always reflecting on where they came from and their roots. I have the privilege of talking and coming across so many young people, if we just talk about young people for a minute. Mm-hmm. And what affects them is their communities, their upbringing. And I'm really passionate about opportunity for all.
Yep.
And sometimes there are challenges and barriers along the way of when people are trying to get to certain points in their life. So can you take us back? I mean, you've just started in terms of you sitting in a dance class with your sister. But can you reflect back on how old you were and what type of family upbringing you had from that? How did you do at school? You know, what were the barriers and challenges or the celebrations of school? And what were those milestones that you had to get through in the earlier part of your life?
I can't really talk about it without talking about, again, my parents. Yeah. So my mum and dad from a very, very working class background, yeah, from two very working class parts of Manchester. My dad actually was raised in Ireland before coming to Manchester and didn't have much. So when my dad started working very young, because my nana couldn't work, she had arthritis, so he'd work to help contribute. So he was working from being 14. So he wasn't really able to pursue anything that he would have wanted to. My mum did want to dance when she was young, didn't have the funds to be able to do it. So my granddad actually helped set up a Morris dancing troupe so that my mum could do something.
Oh, fabulous.
And then together, him and my mum ended up teaching in the area for Morris dancing. Shout out the Ridgeway Rosettes.
Yeah, I'm just visualising it now, yeah, actually. But isn't that a great story of where it all started?
Ironically, years later, I ended up teaching some of the children of the people that my mum and my granddad had helped years ago.
Yeah.
So when I wanted to dance and box and anything I wanted to do, my sister was dancing, my younger brother was dancing as well.
Yeah.
My dad basically worked 7 days a week, and he'd get up at 4 or 5 in the morning, go to work. He'd get back at about 6, 7, have his dinner with us, go to bed, do it all again. Wow. My mum would ferry us around from dance class to dance class, because even though we didn't have the most either, we're also very working class. They wanted to make sure that we had all the opportunities they didn't have.
Yeah.
So I can't thank them enough. They made sure that we had those opportunities. And because of that, I think seeing how much they sacrificed for that, it was a case of, I'm not going to take it for granted. It was never a question for me about taking days off and that kind of stuff. It was just like, no, I'm going to put everything into it because they're putting everything into it for me.
Yeah.
So like, I can never play down the amount of support I've had. It was amazing and I'm so grateful for it.
Aww.
In terms of school, I was actually really, really academic. Yeah, I was really, really academic. If something fascinates me, then I need to know everything about it.
Yeah.
But I also, my brain works in weird ways. So there was times where I wouldn't perform in tests and they had to bring my mum in to be like, can you sit with him? Because he's really intelligent, but he's not doing well in the tests.
Right.
And my mum would sit with me. And this was in like year one or two or something. Like, I was really young. And I'd work out the correct answer. And then instead of moving on to the next question, I would just find all the other ways I could get to the same answer and stay on the same question the whole time. So yeah, school was a weird one where if I was interested in a topic, I would do really well.
Yeah.
And I might do really well one year. And then the next year, I might have a teacher that I sort of didn't gel with and they didn't know how to help me. And then that year, I just fall out of love with the topic and wouldn't like it.
Okay.
But overall, I did well in school.
Yeah. I want to unpack the neurodiversity side of things. Mm-hmm. And I know that you were a certain age when you were diagnosed with autism. Yep. But I just want to park that for a minute because I think it will be really beneficial to hear the story because I feel that it happens to so many people, the journey up to where you were diagnosed and then how it felt and the examples. And you've already given a few, haven't you? And the challenges and the celebrations around that. Because at that time, the people around you were probably just thinking, what's going on with Tom then? He's performing in this exam or this test really well. And then in another moment, it's exactly the opposite. So I'm so fascinated about the brain and I'm so into cognitive diversity and bringing teams together with all their magic to make something really powerful in terms of whether it's education or other things. So you were classed as academic being at school.
Yep.
Did you get any help or can you just carry on the journey of that a little bit more for the next few years after?
No, I didn't get any help because obviously I wasn't diagnosed at the time, didn't know. I think for me, in terms of academic stuff, because I was performing, it wasn't really much of an issue.
Yeah.
For me at school, the main issue was social stuff, like social cues and things like that.
Yeah.
But, and there was loads of times at school that I felt like I'd go home thinking, why did I say that? Or like I'd miss social cues and there'd be awkward silences after I said stuff. And I think luckily, because I had this skill that I did outside of school, like I would come to school and I would have won something on the weekend or I was performing well at this skill and it almost gave me a social currency.
Yeah. So it created a balance as well, didn't it?
Yeah. Obviously, being a young lad at school, being able to do a backflip, it was like, oh, Tom's cool immediately because he can do a backflip. Do you know what I mean? So I feel like a lot of the awkwardness and a lot of the social issues that I had kind of got overlooked by the fact that, oh, but I'm friends with the kid that can do a backflip. So I think it kind of not disguised it, but almost gave me a level of social currency that let a lot of things go sort of, people didn't bring awareness to it or didn't pick on me for it.
Yeah,
because of the other side of stuff.
So it sort of maintained your self-esteem and your confidence. Yeah. Did you have lots of friends at school?
So I was a bit of like a floater. I was friends with everyone, but I wasn't like really close with anyone.
Yeah.
It was a bit of a strange one.
Yeah. And did you come out of school with GCSEs and things?
Yeah, I did really well in my GCSEs.
So you did a lot of the dance out of school that you just explained. Did you study dance in school as well? Or was that something out of school?
I went to two secondary schools. The second one that I went to was Knutsford High School.
Right.
And they had a really good performing arts department.
Okay.
I did dance there. And the teacher was great because she knew that I danced and stuff at a high level outside of school. She didn't make me stick strictly to the boundaries of the curriculum.
Yeah.
She let me push beyond certain things because she knew that I was capable of it.
Yeah.
She was really good in that.
And that gave you a real sense of security as well. Yeah. When the teacher likes you, you always remember a teacher. So can you remember that teacher's name then? Is that somebody that you
Lisa
really
Scott.
Yeah. Who you will thank for a very long time.
Oh, for ages. She was amazing, yeah.
Let's take you back to the age of 16 then. Did you stay on at school or what did you do at the age of 16?
So at 16, I stayed on for my A-levels at sixth form.
Yeah.
And then did really bad in that first year.
What did you take?
So I did English language.
Yeah.
I did English literature separate. I did dance because I thought, it'd just be an easy one as an extra one. And I did biology.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And I got an A in English literature. And then I got two Ds and a U. But it was because halfway through that year, I immediately wanted to drop out. And I was like, this isn't what I want to do. I was already working professionally as a dancer and I was doing it essentially to have a plan B, but it was getting to a point where the plan B was getting in the way of plan A.
Okay.
So I was like, if I'm already succeeding in plan A, but I'm not being able to take every job that's offered to me because I'm working on plan B, it's getting to a point where I'm essentially choosing plan B over plan A when I could just make plan A work. And my mum was really adamant. Well, my mum and my dad, they were adamant that they wanted me to do my A-levels and stuff. So I had something to fall back on. And during that year, my younger brother got really ill and nearly died. He was in hospital for 6 months. He came out with a left-sided weakness, with brain damage, with epilepsy. And he had a 1 in 10 chance of survival at one point. And when that happened, my mum and dad were just like, you know what, life's too short. Do what makes you happy. So...
Are you happy to say what happened?
He actually got sinusitis.
Okay.
So just like an infected cold.
Yeah.
And there's a very thin membrane that separates your sinuses from your brain cavity. And there must have been a small tear or something in the membrane. And they call it backtracking. So the infection backtracked to his brain cavity, infected his brain fluid, which pushed his brain up on one side of his skull, scarred all the compartments on that side of his brain. Ended up in an induced coma for, I think it was like 3 weeks or something.
Mm-hmm.
Had a bunch of brain surgeries.
Wow, because these life events do change us, don't they? And my youngest daughter nearly lost her life with meningococcal septicemia, meningitis, and it sounded like a similar journey. And I think it's positive to share these things because they are life-changing moments, aren't they, for all families and friends at the end of the day.
Yeah, 100%.
So to get that support from your parents is really, really good. So actually, you weren't that upset that you didn't do so well in your A-levels then? It wasn't something that you beat yourself up about?
No, it was more so that for the second half of that year, I wasn't really mentally there anyway, because I knew that I wasn't taking the second year. It was my AS levels that I did.
Yeah.
So like, I knew that I wasn't staying on for the second year anyway. So like, I was kind of just there in person, but not really there mentally. I'd already tapped out.
Okay. So were you already in a dance academy then?
I was training, but not so much a dance academy. So I'd trained in tap, ballet and contemporary from the age of 6 to being 16. And alongside that, I'd also started to develop a love for street styles, which you don't really go to an academy for. I mean, now there's universities and stuff that work in commercial dance and have hip hop courses and things like this. But at the time, it was just you'd go to local studios and take the open classes and stuff like that. So I was lucky enough that I found mentors that were really good. I was, from being 15 in terms of breaking, I was taught by members of Soul Mavericks, which were the country's top breaking crew at the time, and they were for a very long time, and they mentored me and built me up and trained me, and eventually I joined the crew. So,
wow. So if I just take you back then, when you set out in our system of traditionality, so you did start with the tradition of ballet, tap and contemporary, like we all did, my children did, my grandchildren do. Can you explain to us then that you studied or you took part in those, and then what was the light bulb moment of you wanting to go into breakdancing?
The tap, ballet and contemporary thing was a situation where when my sister wanted to learn to dance, my dad found out, I think through one of his friends at work, a place that was close to us where she could go. So that was tap, ballet and contemporary, modern, all that kind of stuff. So he took her there and I just started joining in. So
you younger?
Yeah, so
she just took her younger brother along with her, and now he's famous.
Yeah, so she's 2 years older than me.
Right.
So I was just dragged along as if, like, sit there while your sister does a dance class or whatever. And just because of music, just got up and started joining at the back. And then because at the time, I don't know if it's still the same, but in tap ballet and contemporary, there wasn't many boys that got involved.
No.
So the minute a young boy was there and just started joining in, the teacher was like, yes. so then I was encouraged, did that for a while. And then obviously growing up in a very working class area in Manchester, people aren't sat around listening to classical music. So I shared a room with two of my brothers growing up. And my older brother, Lee, he's probably one of the biggest influences on me in my life. He's 7 years older than me.
Okay, yeah.
And he was listening to hip-hop. So he had, like, his hi-fi in the corner, all his CDs and stuff. So that's the music I was listening to at home. And he was heavily into hip-hop culture and stuff. And one night, I think it was UK B-Boy Championships, which is a world finals that's hosted in the UK.
Yeah.
It was on I think it was Channel 4 one year. And he saw it and put it on, and immediately I was like, this is what I want to do. Like, in terms of dance stuff, this is sick. Because it was, don't get me wrong, men in ballet and stuff are men. We're not meant to dance like women. You're strong, you're lifting the women, like, you dance like men. But it was like, this is something that is men from the same background as me. It's not middle class boys that have grown up to do. It's like, they're doing something cool. They're dressing how people around me dress and how I like to dress. It was immediately something I related to more. They're dancing to the music that I listen to at home. So yeah, immediately I was like, that's what I want to do. So my mum found us classes for, not straight away breaking, a lot of it was street dance classes and stuff. So like locking, popping, choreography classes, little bits of everything. So went to those in the open classes, and then that's where I found the members of Soul Mavericks. First of all, Gavin. I was introduced to Gavin by someone else that was teaching there at the time. And Gavin took me under his wing and trained me. And then through that, I met Lee. And then through that, the rest of the guys.
So you've got a lot to be grateful, haven't you? It sounds like it's a real whole family approach.
Yeah.
With those roots, going back to those roots in your family and all of that. That's the grounding 100%. Of it all. And it sounds like, and we'll get onto it in a minute, that is still the grounding for you as well.
Yeah, 100%.
And then the influence of all your family and your siblings around you made you into what you are today. And then having those people that can mentor you into what you want to do is like the icing on the cake, really, isn't it?
And well, they're like family to me as well now. So.
Yeah. And that incredible opportunity that comes out of that, I mean, that's just an absolute fantastic story. Then let's move to 18 plus then.
Yep.
So what was happening in your life then after you were 18?
Still training, still dancing a lot, competing, dancing for artists.
Yep.
Traveling all over the world.
Living the dream.
Yeah. Basically, I was doing all the dance stuff that I'd grown up wanting to do. Life was a bit crazy.
Yeah. It just sounds absolutely fantastic, though. When we were informed that Tom Malone Jr. was coming on the podcast today, in my world, I think of this family on the sofa with these big dogs across all of them and going home on a Friday night after a long week at work and watching something that is really funny and just really straightforward and really natural and not having to think about it too much.
Yeah.
So can I ask you, how on earth did your family get onto Gogglebox? What was that all about?
We were scouted.
Yeah.
I was teaching at the time at Studio 25 in Manchester at Shockout, and my mum was on the reception. I think they rang up the day before. When they scout people, they say, oh, do you know anyone who'd be good for it? They explain the concept, that kind of thing. And they spoke to Sue, who was the owner of the studio.
Mm.
And Sue suggested us. Didn't tell us, because she's got a million and one things going on. So Sue suggested us and then gone about a day. The next day, they'd come in. So my mum sat on reception, and behind the reception is, it was Studio 2 at the time, but one of the studios, and there's a glass front on it, so you can see into the studio from reception.
Yeah.
So they've come in, they've said to my mum, nice to meet you, we're scouting for Gogglebox, whatever, are you Julie Malone? She said, yeah. And they've gone, is that Thomas? So my mum's turned around, and me being me, I'm stood with my head against a wall doing this. Because I'm trying to work out why my windmill to head spin wasn't working right. So I'm like this. And my mum's looked at me and gone, Yes, that's Thomas. And they must have thought he's a lunatic already, so that would be good.
By the way, for our listeners, Tom's just sort of doing a little jig, moving his arms from right to left and moving his head.
Yeah, I had my head pressed up against the wall, basically swinging my arms around. So they must have gone, okay, this already is interesting.
He's in.
Yeah. And they'd not even met my dad yet, so... They spoke to us, they explained what it was. We'd never watched it, so we were a bit like, oh, it sounds a bit rubbish, like watching people watch TV.
Yeah.
Spoke to my dad about it. He was like, yeah, it's not really something we'd be interested in. So we said no at first. And then at the time, they preferred people that said no at first because they didn't want people that would act up for cameras. They wanted genuine people.
Yeah.
So then that made them even more eager. So then we said, well, we've got six dogs, like it wouldn't work. And they were like, even better. And then... My dad was like, well, if there's cameras in the house all the time, what if I come downstairs in my underpants? And then they were like, they're not in your house all the time, don't worry. And then they asked us to do the test shoot and was like, don't worry, we'll do the test shoot. Chances are you won't get it. Loads of people do the test shoots. Most of them don't end up going anywhere. So we were like, okay, we did the test shoot. And then me and my mum were just up late one night and it came on. We were like, oh, it's actually quite funny, yeah. So when they eventually asked us to do it, we said, yeah.
And the rest is history, yeah. Isn't it?
If you want to build on your skills and get yourself on the right path to success, visit the City College Plymouth website, cityplym.ac.uk. You can hook up with courses, download information packs, guides, and much more. Or find us on social media. We're Skillfully Speaking Podcast on Instagram and Skillfully Speaking on Facebook and LinkedIn. Skillfully Speaking, where hidden skills are revealed. Now back to the conversation.
You've explained about this wonderful career and travelling around the world with your dance. So how did Gogglebox affect your dancing career? Because, gosh, you know, we're all wanting inspiring lives and good jobs and things. So, my goodness, you have this dance career. So how did you balance the two of those?
There's not much commitment required for Gogglebox because it's only filming 2 days a week.
And it's all natural, I suppose. You don't have to rehearse.
You just sat chatting rubbish with your mum and dad watching telly. Like, I did that for free all my life. Do you know what I mean? So I was like, easiest job in the world, I'm in.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
So it didn't take too much time away from me training and me travelling and competing and stuff.
Yeah.
It did affect work-wise in terms of I'd been dancing behind artists and stuff. It's harder to do those kind of jobs when people that are casting are thinking his face is known, so he might take attention away from the artist.
Oh my God.
And stuff like that. So it did affect it in that way. Also, there was a time that I did Strictly with the Pros.
Oh, yeah.
In the opening number. And I wasn't allowed to post anything about it anywhere because I was contracted to Channel 4 and it was on BBC. They allowed me to do it, which is great. I'm grateful for that. But I just weren't allowed to promote it anyway.
Can I unpick that a bit more then? Because that just sounds really surreal, doesn't it? You've got this amazing career. You've got this opportunity in terms of Gogglebox, then becoming quite famous with that. But then going back to your dance career and you're doing the backing dancing. Is that right? The backing dancing into something much bigger. But then the people don't want you to take the shine off the people who are at the front of it that may be more famous.
Yeah.
And then you have to be really, really quiet. What does that do for your mental health and, you know, your heart and your soul?
Essentially, it wasn't too much of a hit. It was frustrating and it was annoying at times. But at the same time, like, to me, that wasn't the pinnacle of dance stuff. Like, I'd grown up wanting to do it. And then when I did do it, I was like, oh, this is it. Because dancers are often in the industry seen as sort of second-class citizens anyway, because you're just sort of the last thing people think about. They think about the stage, the lighting, the sound, obviously the act, like all these things first. And then it's like, oh, and we'll stick some dancers in a back room that can come on and dance for them anyway. So I was already kind of over it by then. My passion was the creative side in terms of creating stuff and breaking and competing and being the best I could be.
Yeah.
The dancing behind other people was just sort of like, oh, I get paid for it. And it's cool to be on some of these big stages sometimes, I guess. So I could still do the side that I was most passionate about.
Yeah.
It was more just like, oh, I can't do the work that pays.
I can feel it that you haven't got an ego. So, you know, you answering that question, if you had got an ego, that probably would have really sort of been difficult, wouldn't it, in a situation like that, I think?
I suppose so, yeah. I do have an ego, like anyone else. I just try and keep it in check.
Yeah. You're paying a great price for that now, I think, aren't you?
Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing. For everything that I was unable to do because of Gogglebox, it's also opened a lot of doors for me in other areas in terms of the other TV shows I've done, my social media presence, which obviously, because of that social media presence, I'm now able to help a lot of people with the neurodiversity side of things.
Yeah.
So as much as there was things that it sort of hindered me with, there was also a lot of things that it helped me with. It's not like a poor me, I couldn't do this because I was on Gogglebox, because overall I'm in a much better place and in a much better position to help other people because of it.
Yeah. So then we're going to pick up on the neurodiversity side of things now. And neurodiversity is a huge theme now in today's society, something that wasn't probably talked about or diagnosed years and years ago. Is really, I think, at the forefront of lots of things now. We talked about your younger life. We talked about when you were at school and doing your exams and your tests and that social side of things and those social interactions. So can I take you back on that journey of when you thought there was something different in terms of the neurodiversity side, how that was diagnosed, where were you, what happened? Obviously, you're an absolute ambassador, aren't you, today?
When I was little, I remember thinking, being a kid, walking around and thinking, before I'd even seen the film, The Truman Show, I remember thinking, like, what if I've been put here and everyone else is kind of like acting around me, or everyone else is like robots and they're all here waiting to see how I respond to things. And I had this feeling of being perceived because it was like everyone else understood things that I didn't. So I always felt a bit like an outsider, like isolated. And like I was just being watched, because I was like watching to see how I respond to things, because I knew that I didn't respond to them like everyone else. All my life, people would say to me, are you on the spectrum? Or you must be on the spectrum, all these kind of things. My mum actually took me to the doctors when I was young.
How old? Can you remember around?
I was really young. I must have been about 5 or 6.
Yeah.
I don't remember it.
Yeah. But she just because there was something different.
Yeah. Because she was like, he doesn't communicate like other kids. Like if I'm super zoned in on something, like if I'm hyper-focused. At the time, it would be like if I was reading or if I was playing or something. My mum could shout me and I just wouldn't respond as if I just hadn't heard her at all. And they literally just tested my ears. I think because I didn't present like Rain Man... They literally tested my ears and the doctor said, no, there's nothing wrong with him, he's just ignorant. So yeah, I was diagnosed with being ignorant.
Is that really true?
So I was diagnosed as ignorant at a very young age.
So did you feel that that was true when you started carrying on from that time, well, that surgery?
He didn't say it to me, he said it to my mum.
Okay.
And my mum told me, I was probably in my teens when my mum told me the story, because my mum always was adamant that I was probably on the spectrum, or she knew there was something different about me.
Yeah.
And like, credit to my mum, my mum's very much like, she treats all her children as individuals. So like, she knows how if my brother's upset, he's going to respond to things in a very different way to me, and she'll give him what he needs but won't necessarily give me the same treatment, because she'll give me what I need, which is often space.
So we don't all fit in the same box, do we?
Exactly. So I'm super grateful for the fact that my mum doesn't parent in like a one size fits all kind of way.
Yeah.
And my dad as well. Yeah, I was always just treated as an individual, and what my needs were just what my needs were. So I always had support, and I think I thrived because of that. But yeah, she told me when I was a little bit older, she was like, oh yeah, I'm sure you're something like autistic or something. But like, I took it to the doctors, they just said you was ignorant. So it was kind of like a running joke in the family that I'd been diagnosed as ignorant.
Wow.
And then it was when I got older and my siblings started having children, one of my sisters had a son who was diagnosed. And then my other sister, during the time that I was living at home, I had to move back in for the pandemic.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
Because to film Gogglebox, I had to be living at home so I could film it. So I moved back in during the pandemic, and my sister was living there with her 3 children, all under 5 at the time.
Oh, wow.
And Carson, her youngest, he was suspected of being autistic.
Yeah.
And it was for all the things that I used to do as a child.
You could relate to it totally. And you were living so closely together then. Lots of you in one household.
Obviously, in that time frame of 25 years since I was his age, a lot more progress has been made in terms of people understanding autism. So the things that he was doing that had gone missed when I was a child other than my mum, were now like, oh, he's showing the traits of being on the spectrum. So I'd got to a point where I was like, it doesn't affect me now. I know that I respond to things in a certain way and I've found coping mechanisms for myself. So I didn't ever think about going to get diagnosed. And at that point, I was like, you know what, let me find out, because if I am autistic and he gets confirmed as autistic, I've already got another nephew that is autistic, then they're not going to have to grow up feeling alone, because it's like they can come and speak to me about things knowing that I'm the same. And not obviously people have different things on the spectrum, but knowing that I understand what it's like
to
feel different.
You can relate to what they're going through.
Yeah, exactly. And also that they can't use it as an excuse. In terms of like, because I didn't know, I never was confined to this box that a lot of autistic people are thrust into, where it's like, oh, they can't do that because they're autistic, but they've not been given a chance to do it. It's like, we can find out for ourselves what our limits are. And for them, they'll have the opportunity to do that, because it can never just be like, oh, but such a body said that autistic people can't do that, because it's like, well, your Uncle Tom did it.
Yeah.
So if you want to do it, feel free to go and try it. And
so
if
you're their role model to say
almost.
That if they put a barrier up around it, you can say, oh, but.
Yeah. And if it's not something that they want to push and try, that's absolutely fine. If it's not for you, that's fine. I'm not telling them that the things that they struggle with aren't valid.
No.
It's just, if it's something that you've been told you can't do, but you do want to do it, go and do it.
Yeah.
Because no one else can stop you but yourself.
Yeah. So then you're all in the same house in terms of going through COVID. You learnt lots from each other, and then you could relate to some of the things that your nephews were going through.
Yeah.
So we come out the other end of COVID. So in terms of your lead ambassadorship with autism, then where are you now with that?
Shortly after, I realised that with social media now, there's probably a bunch of kids out there and young people, even adults, that still feel misunderstood even after a diagnosis. And I was like, for those kids that are finding out that they're being diagnosed, they can go online and see people now where they go, I can relate to that person, I'm not the only one. If I can be that for my nephew, I could be that for other people, essentially. So I decided to start posting more about it, being open about it, and also challenging the stereotypes, because I don't fit a lot of the stereotypes. In some ways I do, like in my bag I've got a 1,500 page epic fantasy book that I've been reading, like about different dimensions and magic and all these things. Like, I'm a massive nerd when it comes to stuff like that, like superheroes and stuff. I'm a bit of a nerd when it comes to, but then I do all this cool stuff that you wouldn't associate with autism, like my dance stuff and the traveling and performing in front of thousands of people, which ironically doesn't feel intimate to me at all, because it feels like there's a separation and I'm doing a thing that I'm passionate about. So it's like there's all these ways that I don't fit the stereotypes. And I think for other kids that don't fit the stereotypes, it's good for them to see people out there that are like them as well, or just other people that are breaking the mold. So it gives them the confidence that they're allowed to do it as well.
Yeah.
And that's when I started doing more of that stuff on social media and eventually becoming an ambassador for the National Autistic Society as well.
So what does that entail then, being an ambassador for the National Autistic Society?
Helping raise awareness.
Yeah.
The amount of people that message on my stuff with things that they don't understand and stuff. There's a great charity out there that you can get resources from, the National Autistic Society. In fact, when I was diagnosed, before obviously I'd posted anything about it, before I spoke to them or worked with them, one of the resources that I got sent from the psychologist that diagnosed me was the National Autistic Society.
Okay.
The stuff they're doing is amazing to raise awareness, to create a world that's more aware about the things that autistic people deal with, and to make people more understanding and accepting of it is amazing. And anything I could do to drive more awareness towards that, I'll do.
Brilliant. Is there anything that you would tell your younger self now, of what you now today, than what you went through when you were younger?
I'd tell him a lot of things to bet on or invest in. Just that it's all right to be different. Being the same as everyone else is boring.
Yeah.
In fact, a big one would be that little slip up that plays on your mind for days or weeks, or sometimes I might still think about it now where I'm like, why did I say that? And it's from years ago and stuff like that. Those things that you're aware that maybe feel a little bit awkward for you, other people probably hear it. They might notice it for a second ago, that was weird, and then move on, and then they don't think about it again. And you're still sat there for weeks later thinking embarrassed or like a little bit of shame about it because you misread a situation. No one else cares.
Do you still get that today, or are you over it all? Yeah, so that's really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think that it's a journey and it carries on forever and it's still, you're still reflecting and still get the feelings around certain things.
I think growing up undiagnosed as well and not understanding why I struggled with social cues the way other people didn't.
Would that have made it better? Would it have made it easier?
I think I would have been able to give myself grace earlier.
Yeah.
But for a long time, I was just like, why am I not the same? Why don't I understand things the way other people do? Like, it seems natural for everyone else and I can't get it. And for a long time, it was frustrating. It was kind of like a why me? Why do I struggle? And now I give myself grace for it. But I think because I've spent so much of my life being confused by it and like replaying things back over and over and over, there's always an element of like, oh, why did I say that? Like, I've done it again. And I can still give myself grace from it now. So it's not the same. Like now when it happens, I'm like, I'll think about it. And then I'll be like, it's no point. It's whatever. Like, I can't help it. So yeah, I think grace is the important bit.
So you feel more positive about giving it a label and knowing than actually trying to struggle through thinking, why do I feel different and why is that happening and so on and so forth?
This is the thing I get asked a lot. It's like, why do you need to put a label on yourself and these kind of things? And the way I look at it is everything's a label. A label is just how we describe things. Your nationality is a label. Your race is a label. Your sex is a label. Like all these things are labels. And like labels with clothes, the label's there to describe the clothes so you know how to take care of it. So the way I look at it is I have this label of being autistic and that just helps me know, okay, I struggle with these things because I'm autistic and then these are the best ways to cope with that because I understand myself. So that understanding allows me to give myself that grace and allows me to have better things in place in order to support me when I'm struggling with certain things.
Tom, I was here thinking, should I say that or not? And I'm so glad I did, because that answer was so articulate and just explains so much. If we sort of move on to health and well-being and your own mental health, obviously we live in quite a fractured world at the moment. And we've talked quite in depth about neurodiversity and autism in particular. And then obviously mental health in the world at the moment is something that we're all focused on supporting, and health actually. So if we just talk about general health, other than the dancing, obviously, what must keep you absolutely fit? How do you keep yourself physically fit?
Boxing.
Yeah.
I boxed as a kid as well. So as an adult, I've refound my love for boxing, and the days that I'm not dancing, I'm boxing. And just, I find that having something that's more of a sport,
yeah,
and has a bit more of like a game element to it really helps me stay fit in an easier way than just going to a gym and
something
working
in a
out.
Team then, doing something with other people than your own?
Not even necessarily a team, just something that has a goal to it.
Okay.
So like if I was to go in the gym, I'd just get bored quickly because I'm like, what is the aim of lifting these weights? Whereas when I'm like at the gym and I'm training because it's boxing stuff or dance stuff, I know that I'm training to physically better myself for a goal. So when I'm doing that, it doesn't feel like I'm doing this grueling sort of thing. It's like, this is just the work that needs to get done so I can achieve the thing I want to achieve. And I kind of stop thinking of it as I have to do this bad thing to get this good thing. It's just, this is what I do.
Yeah. So that leads nicely on. What do you eat then? Are you careful with what you eat? What sort of things do you eat? And are you conscious of all that sort of stuff?
So I eat anything, apart from on Fridays at the minute because it's Lent. So, but yeah, I eat pretty much anything. I just make sure that I tend to be around. Yes, I make sure that I'm around my calorie maintenance.
And do you eat your fruit and vegetables?
Yeah, I do. I was a really picky eater as a kid as well, actually. That's one of the things that gave it away from an early age, that my mum knew that there was something. Like, she used to have to put me on these supplement shakes.
Yeah.
But they were called Build Up at the time.
I remember those.
Yeah, so I had to take those to make sure that I kept weight on, because I wouldn't eat at times, or I'd eat something really restrictive for ages. I remember I ate cucumber sandwiches and that was the only thing I'd eat for about 6 months at one point.
I don't know whether there's a link with that, you know, with with autism as well. I don't know whether
So a lot of it is because autistic people don't like change. We'll find something that we like and we're like, I know I like that. So it removes any unsurety around different food if I just stick to that.
Yeah.
Like whenever I'm eating good or whatever, I can fall into a loop of just eating the same meal every day. And I don't feel that it's a bad thing, because I'm just like, I just know that it's going to taste the same every time. and I know what it is, and that feels safe to me. And I think that's a lot of it. A lot of autistic people have a thing called ARFID as well.
Okay.
Because if you're autistic, I think it's you're four times more likely to have other comorbid conditions. And ARFID is one of them. And ARFID is basically where people can't eat certain textures or just certain things, that they have to have their safe food.
So how good that we're discussing this, because families, parents will be really worried. Take the autism to one side. So if that's studied and diagnosed, but then trying to get your children or people in your family to eat and what you've just described actually makes perfect sense and then links things together, which I think is really good that people understand that, because people will worry about that, won't they?
I think it's tied to the sensory issues. Of autistic people, because growing up, there were certain things that I wouldn't eat because the texture of it was horrific. And I was like, no way. Mum, you could put it in anything you want. I'm not eating it.
Yeah.
God bless my grandma. She used to grate onions into my food. Yeah. She used to chop onions for everyone else. And in my food, she would grate onions in so they would dissolve, so that I'd still get the nutrients but wouldn't have the texture of onions. I was lucky I had people around me that did.
Well, there's so much pressure to do that right, isn't there, for parents as well, for their children, and getting the right nutritional need and different things.
I think that's another struggle, is that not every children needs the same parenting, like we were talking about before. So for neurodiverse children, it's whatever can help you get your child to eat. That's how you need to get your child to eat. So like, if your child needs to eat a certain way, the end goal is that they're eating, they're not starving. So do what you need to do. And I think there's so much pressure on parents that they have to do things a certain way, or the right way, or this way or that way. And sometimes for neurodiverse children, that's just not what's going to get them to do it.
And I've seen it. And there's a big thing about people shouldn't be judged. Because if you can get your child to eat something, that's better than nothing, isn't it, 100%. At the end of the day? Yeah. Going back to trying to fit everything in one box, isn't it, really? So how do you keep yourself mentally fit?
Again, the same thing. I think because I have goals and I work towards them, and I'm a very firm believer of like, slow progress is better than no progress.
Yeah.
So even if I have a day where like I might go to train and it feels like a rubbish day, like I feel a little bit slow, like I'm not landing the new move I've been trying or something, like the way I look at it is that session means I'm that little bit closer the next session. So the slow progress, rather than it being a negative thing, it still steps in the right direction. So I'm still more avid about those goals. As long as I'm moving towards them, I'm doing something productive.
Yeah.
And controlling the controllables. Mm. When stuff happens, it's like, can I change it? If the answer is no, then why am I stressing about it?
You can't control the uncontrollable, can you?
Exactly. Yeah. And if the answer is yes, then great, there's something productive I can do. And I think I've always tried to stick to that. And luckily, I've never had too many issues with, well, any issues at all, really, with my mental health.
So that dancing and all that boxing, you see, that's
don't have time
good,
to think about
it?
Anything.
Yeah,
to
me. But physical health, mental health, they all sort of come together, don't they?
Yeah.
In the end, I think. So you're not in Gogglebox at the moment, are you?
No.
Is Gogglebox on TV at the moment? I'm not sure.
They're filming.
They're filming at the moment, aren't they? Can you tell us the here and now and what's going on in Tom's life right now?
I tore my meniscus just before Christmas.
Oh, no.
So, I've just got back into boxing again, and soon I'm hoping that I can break to full capacity again.
Yeah.
But I'm still teaching a lot. Obviously, breaking was in the Olympics. It's not in for LA, but they're trying to get it back in for, I think it's Australia afterwards.
Oh, okay.
Or whatever Olympics is after that anyway. I think they're trying to get it back in for that. It wasn't dropped out because of ray gun.
Okay.
It was decided that it wasn't going to go into the American Olympics way before the Paris Olympics even happened.
Okay.
But yeah, breaking's as big as ever. It's doing well. I'll be at a World Championships with my crew in August, which is actually held in Manchester.
Oh, gosh, how happy are you about that?
I've spent my life travelling all over the place to go to these different competitions.
Gosh, that's crazy.
In Manchester, it was in Manchester last year as well. We got to semi-finals last year.
So you're happy?
Yeah, always. Yeah.
So what do you want to be when you grow up then?
Me. I want to be me.
Good answer. I didn't even give you the heads up that I was going to ask you that, and you came straight out with it, didn't you? That's brilliant. We've covered so much, haven't we? And you've done so much at such a young age, really, which, as I said, is truly inspirational. So what words of advice would you be giving to those listeners out there?
I just think, like we said before, control the uncontrollables. Yeah. Like things that you can't control, there's no point stressing about. And I know that's easier said than done. But the things that you can control, you can make small progress bit by bit. And then outside of that, I always just think if I live in a way that aligns with my morality and the integrity of my values and the way I've been brought up, I always think before I do stuff, I'm like, would my mum be happy with me doing this? That's how I judge. Is this the right decision?
I'm my mum going to be happy with this?
I'm 32 years old and I'm like, am I going to get told off for this? So yeah, I think as long as things align with my integrity and my morals and the way I've been raised and the role models I've had that I look up to, when you die, you can't take money with you, you can't take anything else with you, but you can take your integrity and your morals.
Tom Malone Jr., it's been an absolute privilege to chat with you today, and I think I could just talk to you all day, actually. Congratulations in all that you do. Thank you very much.
Skillfully Speaking is supported by Babcock International. Visit babcockinternational.com. Presented by Jackie Grubb. Produced by Paul Philpott. Production support by Lisa Hartwell. Edited and mixed by Martin Burgess Moon. Video content by Mark Stevenson. Coordinated by Louise Greenleaf. Produced by Fresh Air Studios. Copyright City College Plymouth, all rights reserved.